podcast. Break it down. One, two. This is the We Own This Town.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to do my awkward intro here, and then we'll jump into it. Hello, and welcome to the We Own This Town podcast. I'm your host, Michael Eads, and I'm here to present a special edition of the show, showcasing a staple of the Nashville music scene and a band that grew to be one of my absolute favorites. That band will be playing at Mercy Lounge this upcoming October 7th to celebrate their 20-year anniversary. I am talking about none other than Glossary. But before I get ahead of myself, I'd like to take a moment to introduce my guests. I'm fortunate enough to be joined by two members of the band to talk through the history and the discography and all sorts of little anecdotes. So, gentlemen, would you introduce yourselves and what your role in the band is?
For BJ.
Go for it.
Yeah, go for
Hello.
It. Hello.
Hello, how are you doing, Michael?
I am well.
My name is Bingham Barnes. Some people call me BJ Barnes.
All right, and what did you do?
I play the bass guitar.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, you want me to get specific about
Yeah, I want you to get specific. What kind of bass? Oh, go through all the basses you've played in 20 years.
No, it's just there's
He's only played one bass.
There's basically one. I own like five, but there's only one that really counts.
Well, does it have a name?
Yeah, no, I didn't name it, but it's just a Rickenbacker I bought in Johnson City.
Oh.
When I was like 17 years old.
No shit.
Yeah. Morel Music, Johnson City.
Wow. It's really stayed with you that long?
It has stayed with me. I bought it behind my mom's back because she was always trying to tell me to save my money up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was mowing yards, and I had a paper out, and I had $100 in my pocket. And I saw...
Burning a hole in it.
Yeah.
You got that Rickenbacker for $100?
I got it for... Well, I'm an idiot. I got the first Rickenbacker I ever had for $225. And then I wanted to, like, thump, like, and pop, like, Flea. So I got, like, Flea was playing Spectre at the time, mm-hmm. and Kramer came out with a cheap version of Spectre. So I sold it, and it was a 71. I'm an idiot, and I bought that Spectre. But anyway, I found another one, and I was the second owner. It was $550.
Uh-huh.
Still have it.
All right.
Yeah, I'm proud of it. That's why I talked about it. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's great. I thought
it's
you
the
were...
bass of the whole band. So yeah, I thought it's you on were... every record. It's the bass. Yeah.
I thought you were gonna go more Primus influence than Flea.
I'm no, I just well, the thing is, like, dude from Primus was just I could never figure out how to play that stuff. I mean, trust me, I tried.
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever listened to like Tommy the Cat?
Oh yeah, it's insane.
Oh dude, Jerry's a Race Car Driver? No way.
They're crazy.
And plus, it's like fretless and. More strings, and it was just like
too advanced for a 17-year-old.
Well, no, but yeah, it was just like that was those basses were expensive,
right?
And then I had a cool bass teacher, and he was like, you know, you gotta play with your fingers, and you only need four strings.
He's like, dude, in AC/DC plays four notes. He never pops and smacks, and he's a millionaire.
Yeah.
So moving on. This is Joey.
I'm Joey.
Joey from Purple Sonja.
Yep. Joey Kanizer. Play guitar and write songs and sing.
I'm happy to hear you pronounce your last name. I think I've been guessing at it for 20 years.
Yeah, oh, man, he's been called Kanizer so many times.
Kanizer, Kanizer.
Well, Kanizer's correct.
Kanizer, Nizer.
Kanizer. Yeah. It's a much harder K than I thought.
It's just straight up, yeah. It has a,
that sounds like Ebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, it's just
Kanizer. You could be like King of the Jews.
How do you know I'm not?
You great might be. Question. Yeah. You might be.
All right, so now we know who we're talking to.
Yep.
I am just, you know, going to jump right in. Thank you so much for joining me, number one, and hosting. We're in Joey's house right now in this lovely kitchen recording.
Sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does sound great. These mics are very professional. This is the best We Own This Town has ever sounded.
Eat your heart out, Mark Maron.
So I just want to say, I just want to ask, like, tell me like a little bit about where you're from originally and then how the band formed. I'm curious. I know that the band formed in Murfreesboro 20 years ago. So how does that come to pass? And do your stories match up in terms of the original formation?
Go, Joey.
Yeah.
I bet they'll match up.
Well, they'll match up because me and BJ are both from East Tennessee. I mean, that was our original pull to each other when we met each other, is that he was from Greenville and then I was from Oak Ridge, which, you know, he's more East than I am. But, yeah, I moved to Murfreesboro in 1995 to go to MTSU. I met BJ, like, within the first year I was there. I actually met him because... there's this band that I loved in Nashville that was here in the early to mid 90s called Crop Circle Hoax.
Oh yeah.
And I loved them when I was in high school, and they were kind of like Nashville's like REM or something. They were like just good 90s kind of pop, jangly pop. And I went and saw them when I first moved here, and they're like, "Oh, if you're in Murfreesboro, you gotta go find Bingham Barnes. You gotta meet
Bingham Barnes." Crop Circle Host told you to meet.
They're Bingham. Like, "You've got to go meet this guy, wow. Bingham Barnes."
I didn't know this
because he was the running the radio station at the time.
Yeah.
So and so he's like, you've got to meet Bingham. He's the guy to meet. And so of course I went down there.
That's the guy to meet.
Yeah. And then, but I think that I ran into him anyway.
Right.
Like I don't. But
Murfreesboro is a small place.
Yeah. It's and at that time it was really small. I mean that would have been when there was like 40,000 people in Murfreesboro when the Walmart was inside the mall.
Yeah.
And as soon as you left the mall, you might as well be in Franklin. There was nothing.
Yeah.
It was a tiny, tiny town.
No, I think there's 17 Walmarts.
Who knows? I mean, there's at least, it's got to be like 110,000, 115,000 people there now.
Yeah, but I think four Walmarts.
That
wouldn't maybe be surprised.
Five.
But,
too many Walmarts.
Yeah, and so I met, when I met Bingham, and BJ was in a band called Daphne's Operation at the time with our friend, with who I would become friends with, Jason Manley. And they, we just talked about making I don't even know how I met Jason. I guess from going to Daphne's Operations or something.
Yeah, well, we got that practice space together. You guys.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's what happened.
So you had a band space at the time, too?
Yeah, I was in a punk band called Situation No Win. So I was in, like, just a like, really fast kind of hardcore punk band. And then
they were amazing.
And then we
hear it.
You know, we were all obsessed with 90s indie rock at the time. We were like super obsessed with like Sebado and thought
Small Factory.
Yeah, well, we thought kind of, I think when we started the band, it'd be like Sebado, you know, it'd be like three different songwriters. Everybody swaps around like the early Sebado stuff. And whoever sang would sing and play guitar, and then the other people would play drums and stuff. And so that's how the band started. And the first shows we played were like that. BJ had songs.
Yeah, I played drums.
And then we are, yeah.
So there's always a revolving cast of like each song changed.
I'm sure it was painful to see us play because it was like, all right, thanks for listening to that song. Now let's all switch.
Yeah. It probably took 20 minutes between songs.
And we probably tuned without tuners.
Oh, God. I'm sure we did. Absolutely. We tuned without tuners. But, and then I think that, and then at some point, Jason and his wife had been his future wife had been recording stuff. They've been living together and they're recording songs on the four-track.
Maggie, we bought, remember at that music store that was off the square on Vine, that you could buy all kinds of awesome cheap stuff. And I found that Realistic Moog synthesizer.
Yeah.
Or you can say Moog. I don't know what people say. It's still undecided.
I don't judge.
Yeah.
But it was $25 and I bought that thing.
Yeah.
This
was the 90s.
I know.
This is the 90s. This is the kind of thing that happened.
Those things are worth like $800 now. It's crazy. But Maggie destroyed it.
But well, I think before that, though, I think that he had played us some like four track, or he had played some songs with her, and we're like, oh, she can. You know, when you're young, I mean, I was like 22, so you would have been 23.
Yeah, I was like 20, something like that.
Yeah.
So this is 95.
This would have been 96.
No, it's been 97.
96 now, 97.
Yeah, it's 97.
And you
think we were talked about it in 96, but it wasn't till the beginning of 97 when we actually played.
So that's hence the 20-year anniversary.
Yeah. So.
So like both of our bands were sort of breaking up at the same time.
Yeah.
Even though like we got this practice space together.
But Jason's in Daphne's Operation, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's breaking up and just
forming. Well, PJ's the bass player for Daphne's Operation.
I was the bass player.
Right.
Yeah. And Joey was in a situation when we shared the space.
Right.
And so that's we became good friends. I mean, I remember just sitting out at the Mass Comm building, like, we should get together and jam. Yeah, we play some poppy songs that people will like.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Well, we were just into that in 90s indie rock stuff. We liked, you know, like everything that everybody liked at the time that was into indie rock. You know, we loved like Pavement and the Pixies and Archer's Loaf. And we liked some obscure bands like Small Factory. And I mean, we were just obsessed with Merge, with like Spent, Butter Glory, all of those kind of bands. We loved all that stuff. Obviously, like Sonic Youth, lots of noise, kind of bands. And so we were like, let's make a, that's why I think we love the idea of having Maggie, because we had so many bands that we love, a boy, girl, and we're like, we got to get Maggie, you know, we can have like,
so that's the first lineup of the band at that time. That's just a four piece.
Well, I think we played maybe a couple of shows with just me, just BJ, and Jason. And then she joined in pretty quickly after that.
So that forms the first record. Mm-hmm. Is there a 7-inch before that? I seem to recall. There's a 7-inch before. 7-inch is the very first thing.
Yeah.
It was with Kissing. We did a split with our friend Andrew Caffer, and his band was called Kissing Book. We sort of pulled our money together off of doing some shows together, and just cool.
I love that.
Put it out together, and we went on a tour.
You went on a tour after the 7-inch. How far reaching was this?
Did we go all the way to New York City with that one?
I don't know.
We went through West Virginia towards New York City. I think we took my 85 VW Vanagon and engine blew by the end of the tour.
Yeah.
It did. Vanagon's not really
a good. It's a four-cylinder.
It's not
like,
a great.
With like five people and like 500 and pounds gear. Of gear.
Right.
It's not.
Not a good tour van. Yeah. I thought it was awesome. But I think we went to New York City.
That's pretty phenomenal, though, that you're like doing a legit tour on a 7-inch. Like at that time, like I just,
well, we didn't know any better.
I mean, there's not internet at that time.
There was
really.
There was barely MapQuest.
Pay phones.
Pay phones.
There wasn't MapQuest at that point. No. There would have been pay phones and it would have been calling card.
But yeah, I remember getting into New York and like having to pull over that first gas station when you get out and be like, we're here.
Yeah.
How do we get there? In those early days, even in the band I was in before, the punk band, you know, you would drive into town. You would hopefully see somebody that looked like you to see where they were going or something that they might know and ask them. Or, like, I feel like human beings used to have to do something which they don't have to do now, which is they kind of go off their senses. Like, you pull into town, you'd be like, this feels right.
Yeah,
you know, and you kind of drive around and you kind of, like, look. It's like, well, this looks like a part of town that would have a bar, you know. And then you might, you know, you would kind of, maybe you would ask somebody. But sometimes you just... You just come across it, you'd be like, oh my gosh, you know. Totally. We would see like some kids that like, oh, like that car's got stickers on it, you know. Follow them, and then you know,
holy shit, that is such a wildly different headspace to be
radar it in.
Yeah,
I mean, you'd have to do that, and we would, you know, you'd have to stop in a payphone, and we lived off calling cards. That's back when you could buy a calling card and had certain minutes on it, and you could call the number, and then you just call the promoter, the kid who set up the show, and write down the directions.
So are these at venues or house shows or a mix?
Mix.
That's cool. Yeah. So then you come back from the 7-inch tour and you have more songs. You're ready to record like a full length. Is that the general path that took?
Probably.
I mean, at that time, it was like writing hundreds of songs.
Right.
Like, Joey wrote
just enormous amounts of songs.
Joey wrote like five songs a day.
So does it quickly change from being everybody has songs that they're writing to being more you're bringing
hundreds of songs? Well, it became me and Jason.
Yeah.
You and Jason
writing
more
me
songs.
And Jason was writing songs and that weird. And then briefly there, when it became like that, when we realized like, oh, like we have more interest in writing songs than we do in playing drums or something, we had Gabe Beeler, we had somebody play drums with us for like a year and a half, who filled in and played drums just so we could just focus on writing songs and me and him playing guitar, because we were so into all those 90s dual rock, you know, all those 90s bands that were influenced by television, you know, or like Gang of Four and stuff like that. They were all like the melodic, nobody plays the same thing, everybody's like playing different things, and so we were like, I'd rather play guitar. We want to sound like Arch the Loaf or something, or like Pavement, you know, like weird melodic interesting guitar stuff. And so we got more into that, but and that was like kind of the golden age for four tracking for me. And so I was like, I mean, I didn't do any, I had no life for like maybe 3 years. All I did was sit at home and record a song, and I recorded like a song a day.
Wow.
For like 3 years.
Just demos, like on demos on
hundreds
demos.
Of hundreds of hundreds. I mean, there's, I've probably got 300 four track tapes in the other room. Like I was telling you before, like I can't drive. I've never been able to drive. So I've always been stuck at the house. And the only way I've ever been able to like go anywhere is like in my head. And so I would just record hours and hours every day, just recording songs, writing songs, recording songs. So yeah, there was a bunch of those in that era of like, and it's funny when you look back, you know, when you're younger, like time, the distance between years seems so much longer, and as you get older, the distance between years is so short. Absolutely. But when you're young, you know, it's like if you think about like being, you know, the difference between being like 15 and 16 is ginormous.
Eternity.
It's eternity.
Yeah.
But like being, you know, I'm 42, so being 41, 42 is like, what did I do last year? Yeah. it's like that.
I'm 38. I'll be 40 in a blink of an eye, for sure.
Yeah, and it's so...
You'll be 44 before you know it.
Yeah, and I mean, it just happens so quickly. And so I look back at that time, and I'm just like, I don't know what was going on, but yeah, I mean, it was just... That lineup of Glossary lasted for 2 years, but there was like I don't know, probably... 70 songs that were recorded that were never anything,
right?
Or even more than
but it's
that.
Also just like you're learning that art of songwriting and just like you have all these
the
ideas
process
to
is
try
new
out,
and like, so it's just like you're just everything you do is like this is a song. And also came from like a punk underground where I'm just like, you know, anything's a song,
sure,
you just make it up, you just, you know, you know. I mean, we when we started the band, we our whole idea was like nobody's ever gonna care about us, like from the get-go we're like we'll never focus on wasting our time trying to like get on label or focus on anything. I would just do our own thing. And so
well, I mean, I'm glad you were wrong. Yeah. But I do love that mentality because it's a little more pure that way. Like you're writing the songs that satisfy you. No one's coming to you saying like, I don't hear a single on this record. Can we beef up a single? You know, like you're writing the best record, like best collection of songs. That work for you. I think that's very admirable.
And we were obsessed with Superchunk and how they did Merge. So we started our own label, Chant. We're off the bat, we're like, oh, we'll just do, you know, that's what they did.
Yeah,
it's like they just put out your own records, man. Just stop, you know.
Yeah, we were hoping that we would be able to do that.
Yeah. So the first two records were in that 7-inch were just kind of us doing it ourselves with like our friends helping us.
So you've got the, before we get too far past this, you've got all these demos, you've got the 7-inch out, you did the tour, you come to record Southern by the Grace of Location. Where are you doing that in Murfreesboro? Is that done all in one session?
I bet you that record was done in like 2 days or something. What was it, 3 days?
Where did we do that
one?
Was
that Greg's house? Greg Lane?
Greg Lane, yeah.
Yeah. That was like, I bet you that was a weekend we made that record.
Like, yeah, because it was, you know, because we had everything rehearsed and we just had to.
Yeah, and so that's just us through. That's just, you know, the drums are either me, BJ, or Jason on that, like.
Right.
And I can definitely still tell if I'm playing drums.
Because you play really, BJ plays really hard. He's like
hard and rushed.
Well, there's a lot of awesome songs on there, but it is like, it's definitely indie rock, like highly influenced. Like going back and listening to it before coming in here, it's very different from the second record, which has a lot of different influences, which I think is good to let all your influences kind of work on what you put out.
The second record was still like the same people,
but it is different. So like, what happens in between?
What happened in between the first record and the second record is that we like
Neil Young.
It's Neil Young.
Yeah.
So like in the first record. Is like we're just trying to emulate like the Pixies and Pavement and Archers of Loaf and like Velocity Girl or whatever whatever indie rock bands that were big at the time that we liked, you know, we were trying to emulate. And then we at some point, probably between that record and the other one, it was probably Neil Young and probably Towns came in at that time.
Yeah. Okay. Jason was really into Towns.
Jason, he got like really into Towns, and that would have probably been like, you could have still seen Towns because I can't remember if he died in like what year he died, but like, I mean, he lived in Smyrna.
Oh, wow.
So it would have been when we came across Towns Van Zandt, Neil Young. And so we're like, oh, so let's try to move to like a folk or based songwriting or like the emphasis is on songwriting.
It was a conscious effort to change that sound.
Well, it's just like, I mean, what we love. It just was more on like, oh, if you can write a song on an acoustic guitar and play that song and it seems like a song, then it's a song. We don't need to have a bunch of stuff on it, but we still liked
a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, we still liked like the two guitars and like, you know, and so it was kind of that the in between of like, let's be like a Pavement or somebody like that, but like try to write songs like Neil Young.
Also, I think Built Spill sort of came into our lives around that time.
Yeah.
Or was that Built to Spill
would have been. No, it was in that time.
Yeah, it was that time.
And we got to open up for Built to Spill in that.
In that era, really?
Yeah, in that section. We opened up on the Keep It Like a Secret.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. Yeah. I know it's been a while, but that is quite an accolade.
And that's what
else. Oh, that's our day. That's like my claim to fame.
I'm sure you've opened for lots of amazing bands.
There's a couple that I always forget that we opened up for that blow me away. Because the other day I realized it was like we opened up for NRBQ, which is like became one of my favorites of all time. And I was like,
Violent Femmes.
That was cool. Violent Femmes. That's cool.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's a long list, I'm sure. I was, some of my notes here are just, and I don't know if this is even worth investigating anymore or not, but I thought that like West Liberty, like the lead track on the second record, This Is All We've Learned About Living, kind of hints very heavily at like this new direction that you're going. Yeah,
for sure.
But like Fast Walking Shit Talking is like a little nod to where you've come from.
Yeah, for sure.
Like,
for sure.
Right along the lines of what you're talking about, the influences. I think it's fascinating too that like, you know, college kids, that's what happens. You move away to somewhere, either for college or for whatever experience, and you've got all these bands you like, and you meet all these people from other places, and they're like, check this out. out, and then everyone kind of influences each other.
Back then everybody was still handing out cassettes.
I also think there's a point in your life where you turn to, I think that in when people are young, like I think like there's a point where you stop relying and for some reason elevating the music of your time. Like, because there's a time when any young person thinks the music that's happening right now at their era is the best there is.
Right.
And then at some point you get turned on to something that becomes like a gateway or something leads you in, and then you realize like, music has been amazing forever.
Right.
It's just you got to find it or it has to hit you at the right moment. And so I think that like 98, 99 is when we, you know, I got a copy of like Harvest, and I got After the Gold Rush, and that would have been when I got like Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere, and then like all those records, and then we got, you know, then that's when we found Towns, and then we found got Clark, and stuff like that, and we're like, oh, like you can, it kind of triggered this whole idea that I used to always say was like grandpa knowledge. It's like trying to get to where you write grandpa knowledge type of songs,
right?
Like where it's like the only way you can write them is by having lived through something, and so you have to live through something to be able to get to those songs. And obviously at 22 or whenever we made the first record, like I had lived through a bunch of stuff, but I didn't know how to take that, tell my story. It's just like with anything creative, it's like struggling to try to find your voice and where you fit in all of it. You know,
well, that's like, I mean, you're basically describing the sophomore slump. Like, your first record is you've waited your whole life to write the first record. So you have 18, 20 years of experience. And then you hit that second record and what's happened in 2 years? So you're saying.
Although I will say that I think the second record is better than the first record.
No, I agree. I agree in this case. But I was going to caveat that by saying your grandpa knowledge is such an amazing realization that you had in that window because. You are pulling from, you're making a conscious effort to write from an experience viewpoint. Even if it's not something that you experienced, you're saying, I need to write in this way.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason why I came to that conclusion was like before, I mean, I think everybody, the thing that they do is they immediately, when you do any kind of artistic thing, you emulate somebody because it's the easiest thing to do. And so I think what I did was at that moment realize that I needed to, like, if you really focus on being yourself, like, and doing what you do and writing from some place deep inside of you, like nobody can do that. Like you always have a career because nobody can, that's the only way to me was to stand out. It's like we can mimic this stuff that we loved in the 90s and we could like, you know, we could play guitars and stuff like that and try to write songs like that, but it'd never really be us until we figure out how to be us. So, but yeah, I think that was the moment where I realized that like if I really wanted to write, I'd like start digging deep to figure out what it is that I was going to be and try to find my voice. Because once you find your voice, like you're golden, because nobody can be you unless they're emulating you, and if they're emulating you, then you win, you know?
Right.
Like, so there's a million people that sound the same. The goal of being any kind of artist is for somehow, like, to stand out doing, you know, I mean, and not even intentionally trying to stand out, but just trying to get to the truth of who you are. And
right.
And that makes you stand out because nobody else can be you, and nobody's had the same kind of experiences.
I mean, that's an incredibly poignant thing to realize at that point in your life. I mean, that's very young to come to that idea, yeah. I think.
Personally. I mean, I kind of thought I was old at the time, because I would think, you know, I would listen to some of those like, you know, Harvest, and, you know, I'd be like, he's 24. You know? It's like, yeah. He's 24.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd be like, you know, like the first Springsteen record, he's like 19, you know? It's like, I always thought that I was old, too old. Like,
right.
I thought that I was like, what in the world, man? All of the people that, when I really look at a lot of these guys, that, like, you know, you start thinking, you're like looking at people, you're like, Otis Redding was 27 when he died.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, like, maybe when you're in it, that does feel old. But now,
Graham Parsons died when he was 26.
Yeah.
And wow. Like all the stuff that, and, you know, I would think like that. I was always like, what in the world? You know, I gotta move this. I gotta fast track this.
Well, I think you came to the right realization. So, from that point, do you tour on the second record again, or
no? I mean, we never really toured on those first two records. We play shows here and there. Yeah. The thing is like, I mean, and this is gonna bring us up to date, or bring us up into the second life of the band. Is like, it was very apparent that me and Bingham had no idea what we wanted to do with our lives, and really didn't. We weren't planners, you know. We didn't really, you know, we weren't ever thinking long term or like really saw where, you know. We were just like, man, this feels good. Let's just keep doing it.
I wanted to be in a band.
Yeah, I mean, that's. But so Maggie and Jason, I mean, they were like, you know, they come from, you know, I think Jason had just finished college. I feel like he felt like he had a responsibility to kind of go and get a post-college job and kind of like, yeah, we went to La Siesta in Murfreesboro.
Band meeting?
And we split up, and we basically told them, like, we're going to keep doing it. And then, and that would have been when I started dating Kelly. So that would have been like, I started dating her in 1999. The band, that version of the band broke up in 2000. And then we're like, well, we'll just keep the band going. So we got...
Wait, so that version of the band broke up in 2000, but that album doesn't actually come out until 2000? Is that right?
It comes out in 2000.
Okay.
Yeah. It came out, and then the band broke.
We
played a couple times, and then we broke up. And then we were like, well, we'll just get Kelly to be in the band. And there was a brief stint in the band where it was like, there was like an in-between gray area where it was like me, BJ, Kelly, and Ben.
Oh, yeah.
Briefly.
Ben, wow.
Before we got Todd.
Yeah.
And then we got JD.
It's funny. Yeah. Ben Martin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Played drums with us for a little while.
So that's so from 2000, 2003, the band is reforming. No. You're writing new songs. Yeah,
so that would have been 2000, 2001. There was no really songs written at that time. It was really us just trying to play old songs and kind of transfer into the new thing. And then when Ben played with us on like a tour, and then we got home, and then he left, and it was me, BJ, and Kelly. And then Jason came back into the band, but as the drummer.
He just wanted to play drums
and to be in the band. And then so that would have been at the same time Todd joined the band, and Greg Jacks was also on the.
We had six people there for a hot minute.
Well, Greg Jacks joined the band actually towards the end of Maggie and Jason too. So it would be it would have been me, you, and Greg Jacks.
Because we started practicing at his house, and Kelly was his roommate.
Well, I mean, he plays on, This Is All I've Learned About Living. He plays guitar on it.
Yeah.
So.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, he does.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah, so he was in the band at that time, too. So he was the crossover with us.
Yeah.
So when we crossed over, when you added Kelly and Todd and Jason back in the band, and that became the band that is on How We Handle Our Midnights.
Yeah.
So it would have been six of us. It would have been me and BJ, Kelly, Greg Jacks, Todd Bean, and Jason Manley.
Yeah.
And then Jason Manley, he couldn't tour or anything, so then he played on the record, and then we had J.D. Rieger in the band, who was in the band for 4 years, I think.
Yeah, J.D. was with us for a long time.
And then he was the drummer who played on For What and What Will Come.
For What Will Come.
Yeah. Okay. So that's still, that's from How We Handle Our Midnights, 2003, For What I Don't Become, 2006. That's a long span of time.
Yeah.
Are you guys touring a bunch then? Like, are you playing sporadically? Like, do you have day jobs? Like,
oh, yeah, we always had day
jobs. We always had jobs, and we always tried to tour as much as we could.
Mm-hmm. When JD joined the band, we were touring a lot more.
Yeah, but we never, like... I don't know.
Are you recording at home at this point with these things? Are you
recording at Brian Carter's house.
Always with Brian Carter.
So the first three records recorded at Brian's, and then...
Well, the first one was Greg Lane.
Greg Lane's the first one. So second two
were at Brian,
and then we recorded one... we recorded For Don't Become in Texas, and then we came back and recorded with Brian.
Oh, really?
For
Better Angels.
Better Angels is recorded by Marcus
Brown. So For What I Don't Become is recorded in Texas.
It's recorded by Matt Pence.
In Denton, Texas. Yeah, well,
from Central
Maryland. Argyle.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So that one to me feels like I really wanted to... I wanted to come in here and be like, oh, this one has like a noticeable more country influence. But then as I got deeper into the record, I'm like, it doesn't really have a more country influence. It's just like there's some slide guitar here and there.
There you go.
But it's a really big rocking album. It just kind of like took me by surprise right at the beginning.
It's definitely a big rock record. That was like, whenever I think about the sophomore kind of slump, I always think of that record as the sophomore slump a little bit.
Really?
Well, I mean, there's things that I like about that record, but it's like, you know, I started singing because I was writing songs and I wanted to be in a band. I didn't know how to play guitar. And so I just was like immediately started writing songs to play in a band. Like, I couldn't play anybody else's songs. So I just immediately writing songs and I was like, well, I got to sing the song. And, you know, I mean, it just took me so long to get comfortable, like figuring out how to sing. You know, I never was.
So you don't feel comfortable on For What I Don't Become? Like,
For What I Don't Become is probably it's really when it starts, when I think Better Angels was when I was like, felt like, oh, I can, I'm starting to be able to sing, kind of sing now.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, I disagree with you. There's so many great songs on that record, but I do think Better Angels Are Our Nature, from my personal experience, like, I'm personally familiar with the band as far back as the first record. Bingham and I both worked at Spongebath Records together in Murfreesboro. I can remember him bringing in the 7-inch and bringing in the album. I think I might still have Southern by the Grace of Location on CD in my basement somewhere. But like, I was not ready for it because I'm like a few years younger than you guys, and I had not heard Pavement. I had not heard any of the bands that were influencing you. So like, I was like, I like Stone Temple Pilots. I liked a lot of bullshit mid-90s bands. And you guys were listening to cool indie rock. So I wasn't ready for that record. And then by the time like Better Angels of Our Nature rolls around, which is like many years later, I have come to terms with my own influences and maybe gotten some grandpa knowledge. It really grabbed me. Like, it really impacted me from my personal experience with the band. But this is also the album that you give away for free. Like, for some reason or another, I don't know if that was like a marketing idea, if the internet was just like,
I'll tell you what, Radiohead took all the credit for it.
Radiohead, yeah, took your idea.
Well, it came out like the same,
at the exact same time.
It came out same day.
I think same day or like
really?
Two or it was days. Like, I think ours came out a week before. Or something.
A week before them, and we were just like,
no, I'll tell you the reason why that came about was that.
No, we're not bitter.
Now, the reason why that came about that we gave that away for free is that like in between How We Handle Our Midnights and For What I Don't Become is a huge gap. It's like 3 years.
Right.
And the reason why that's, and it's at the time it was like. We were trying to find a way to put it out, and at the time, our manager Bob Andrews, he was trying to find somebody to put it out. We were trying to figure out what to do with, and then he decided to put it out, and it just took forever for it to actually ever come out. And it was like the darkest, most depressing time because the band was like trapped. Like, we wanted to go out. Time had gone by so long of us waiting for the record to come out, and it just never came out. And so I was stuck at the house, and I decided, I was just like, well, look, I'm just going to write Farewell album. Oh. I'm just going to, and so I just spent, all I did was write, I lived, eat and breathe writing Better Angels. And then Better Angels was done when For What I Don't Become actually came out. And so I had to go and like do all, I had to do all this press and you know, interviews and stuff about the record, like sitting on Better Angels and like.
You'd already moved on.
Oh, I was way gone. Because it was like 3 years ago.
Right.
Yeah, it was just like, I was
which
like.
Which isn't that long for a band to go between albums. Like, I'm sure it was grueling.
But when you're like that young, it is.
Yeah.
You know? And when you don't have any money and you're like in limbo in your life and you're trying to figure out if you're doing the right thing or if this is some just like stupid, like petty thing, you need to like, you know, stop being selfish and like, you know. Put your big boy pants on. Like, so it was like killing me. And it was the only thing that I was doing at the time. I was working at a restaurant and then I was just going home writing songs and recording songs. And so when it took so long that when we got past it, because I think it came out in 2006, right?
Yep.
And then we put the other one out, I mean, immediately.
Right.
And we were just like, we're like screw waiting, screw trying to find anybody, give it away. Just put it out. Just get it. It needs to be out there as soon as possible because we felt so good about it and felt that it like had, you know, because that was the first record we had Eric and then everything like became very gelled together. That record was recorded really pretty fast too. And
where did you do that?
At Brian Carter's in Murfreesboro.
Another Brian Carter joint. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. So you put it on the internet and did you feel, obviously I love the reasoning for putting it out that fast, but like, did you feel that it had more impact than waiting 3 years between, or was it just more personally cathartic to like get it out and, no, and have I mean, it out
I,
there?
I think it immediately catapulted the band.
It did.
More right. so than, I mean, it was like the band had been stagnant for so long and then that record came out and then all of a sudden it was like,
yep.
And you have to think even in that time, whenever Glossary started, you know, I remember when, This Is All I Learned About Living came out, like we did not know that Americana, alt country, I had no idea that was a thing.
Right.
Like, none of us did. We didn't know that was a genre. It wasn't until like, whenever This Is All I've Learned About Living came out and we started getting compared to like Whiskey Town and Wilco and all this stuff. And we were like, who is this?
I don't even like those bands. Like, what's up?
Yeah. We were like, who is this? Like, I didn't even know who they were. I mean, we had to go and find them.
Right.
And so like at that time, and even when Better Angels came out, like today in 2017, Americana alt country is like one of the biggest subgenres in the country.
Right.
But like at that time, there was like, I mean, in the South, there was like Us, Lucero, the Drive By Truckers, there was like the Dexateens. There was very few bands.
Right.
I mean, they were just
hard. You didn't even identify as one.
Well, we didn't even know we were one. And then also, we were in Nashville in this area where like nobody was into that. There was no scene for that here. I mean, it was much more of a like the Features were like the biggest band.
Right.
Yeah. You know, people were more into that kind of, you know. So like alt country, Americana, like singer-songwritery kind of rock-based stuff, it was not a thing.
So with Better Angels, do you find that audience somehow?
More so, we found it. More so. I feel like that was where it started, that we realized like, oh, there's a whole community that like this kind of music
right.
that we didn't even know existed.
That's sort of when we... I don't know, the postcards.
Yeah.
Sort of.
There's this whole list. Yeah. Email list that started, I want to say that it started in like the late 80s or early 90s called Postcard from Hell. It was like
all Uncle Tupelo.
It was an Uncle Tupelo fan email group.
Okay.
And they slowly, as it progressed, it got bigger and they started branching out into the, like more indie rock and more and other different kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. And they kind of like picked us up as a band and started touting us and really promoting us. And immediately we'd start, you know, people would come to shows and we're like, oh, you know, I heard about you on Postcard. And we'd be like, what the hell is Postcard?
Yeah.
And it was like this whole underground, like little community that listened to this kind of music. Because, I mean, up until this point, like we had no idea that that was like a genre of music.
Right.
Like, and at that time too, even when kind of people would call you alt country, you'd be like, because we always thought we were a rock band.
Yeah.
First and foremost, we were a rock
band. I mean, you have those influences, but you are a rock band.
Yeah. Like, we always thought.
Start to finish, it's all rock songs.
Yeah, it's a rock band. I mean, it's just, I think that like whenever you're kind of, well, I mean, especially because we'd have pedal steel here and there and stuff, but like, I feel like a lot of times when you are song based, and especially if it's kind of like a blue collar kind of band, which the band was always got kind of just a blue collar band, the only people that can compare that stuff to is like Springsteen and like Bob Seger or like, you know, kind of people like that. And so I think in those people immediately I kind of get pulled into Americana, which, you know, and I was always like, I was always trying to, my kind of into all that stuff was the Replacements, because that was like my favorite band, you know? And so I was always wanting to be like, no, oh, man, we'll be like, we'll write songs, but they'll be kind of rocking and punky, you know?
Right.
Like,
and they are sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I definitely think so. But I mean, I was always just trying to think of it as like a Replacements-y kind of thing.
So on Better Angels, you're discovered by this postcards mailing list. Yep. You're finding a bigger audience. Between this and Feral Fire, the next record, there is another 3 years. Is that 3 years as grueling? Are you touring more? Are you feeling this like sense of relief? Like, you're in your fifth record now. Like, that's got to feel like very, very good that you've like done this thing.
Did Feral Fire came out like 2009?
I have it as 2010. No, but that might be wrong.
I think it came out 2009.
Okay.
I think it did. Well, no, maybe it did come out in 2010, because then I think I had a record. I had the On That Bedroom Revival came out in 2009. So yeah, that's how it was.
You did that in between.
Yeah, I did that between.
Right, so is that when Lucero got?
Lucero put that out.
Lucero puts out Feral Fire.
Yeah, they had their at one point, I can't remember what label they were on. They were kind of had like a little subsidiary, and they let them put out records. And I think they put out us and maybe one other record.
Well, how did that come to pass? Is that from touring? Well, is that just from being part of this world? Or
we became friends with them early because we were the only other band that was like.
And they would come down to Murfreesboro and play with us at like Red Rose.
Yeah, and like the Borough and stuff.
Yeah, and so we were playing with them when they were still.
Are you guys in Nashville at this point? Are you still living in Murfreesboro?
Oh no, we're still in Murfreesboro.
Still in Murfreesboro. All right.
Yeah, that's what I was saying before. I mean, the thing about this, like the Americana kind of scene at the time, like, I mean, if you lived in the South, like the only bands that I even knew like that were like, I knew obviously of like Lucero, the Drive-By Truckers, the Dexateens. I mean, there wasn't, you know, yeah, Blue Mountain. There wasn't like a whole lot of, well, when we loved, what's Duquette's band?
Oh, Verbena.
We love Verbena, which were on Merge. Yeah. And they were like, you know, but there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of Americana type of.
Well, particularly in Murfreesboro, I wouldn't think.
Oh, no.
Right.
No.
All right. So then Lucero puts out the next record. Has the songwriting process really changed at this point? Like, you're saying you wrote Better Angels to be the end. You're like saying, this is it. Here's my final record.
I figured it would be the end because, you know, the other record hadn't come out. And I just was like, oh, man, I think we've wasted my time. And then, of course, you know, I mean, it's like any kind of art. If somebody trying to be an artist, it's like you get a tiny little morsel of something and it keeps you going to the next thing. Right. And then you hit some lull and you're like, oh, it's just like constant state of midlife crisis. And then you get a little bit of something else and it's like, oh, no, something's going to happen.
Right.
And it's like back down. And it's just like highs and lows. And so I think what happened, we started touring so much, and that's what I think is reflected in Feral Fire, because when we went to do Feral Fire, it's more like, oh, so we need to write songs like you would play them live.
Right.
So it's like, let's have just big guitars, like we got to walk into a room where nobody cares about us, and then we have to immediately like, you know, kick in, and then people are like, what? And this is loud, and you know, and so Feral Fire was much more like that. It's like, you know, I always thought it was like, you know, it was like if Thin Lizzy was from like Tennessee or something. Much more of like a swinging and rock and roll and like, yeah, I mean, but it still had like other kinds of songs on there. But there was a lot of like harmonized guitars.
Oh, yeah.
And like, you know, and that too was at the time where I was pretty much at that time listening to nothing but R&B and kind of gospel music. And so we wanted everything to be like, you know, like swinging and like, and like have some kind of like rhythm to it,
right?
Because I really, you know, got really into like rock and roll. You know, I was really deeply into like the history of rock and roll at that point, and just like how much of that stuff, the swinging aspect and danceability, had been taken out of modern rock. Like in a post-punk era, everybody's like, here is the one, here,
yeah,
you know?
Right, right.
Like you, so when you hear a band, I think that's really one of the reasons why like a band like Thin Lizzy or a band like the E Street Band, why they stuck out like sore thumbs is they were like...
Right.
Like a swing.
They had grandpa knowledge. Yeah, they went back and learned their influences. Well,
and they were just like, it was like immediately when you hear somebody kind of swing, you're like, whoa. You know, you like start tapping your foot and you're like, huh.
And Eric, you know, Eric came through with the Easy Shuffle.
Yeah, and then Eric started the Easy Shuffle and we started using that in songs. And so,
it's his signature move.
Can you describe it verbally?
It's basically just the shuffle from Reeling in the Years by Silly Dan.
Or the Purdy Shuffle, like a variant on the Purdy Shuffle.
But we just was like, let's just start swinging everything. That was like when we were just like, yeah, man, I mean, you want to win a crowd over, you just start swinging and people are immediately like, whoa.
So it's not long between 2010 before the, what I'm calling the final record, but maybe that's untrue. Long Live All of Us. Is that recorded in that period of time that you're touring and playing out? Was it already done prior to that?
No, I mean, we rented a house.
That was a Rockville record.
Yeah, we rented a house in Rockville, Tennessee, and recorded it in a house.
Yeah.
Yeah. We rented a house for like 2 months. We rehearsed for like 3 weeks.
It was Kent Goolsby's house, and they were renting it from the Presbyterian church next door.
Uh-huh. It was the old preacher's house.
Yeah, it was a, what do they call it, parsonage?
And then, the irony of it is on one side of it's a church, and on the other side of it was like a meth lab that had been busted. So it was a house that was taped up with police tape.
Classic.
And it was, and being out there, Tennessee. I was like, and there was like a creek behind there too, which they referred to it as a wash, because it really only flowed when
it flooded.
When it rained real good.
Right.
But that the little place that was the meth lab next door, it was like this awesome cabin in the woods, and when we were recording out there and, you know, spent time out in the woods, and I was just like, man, I would love to live out here.
In the meth lab.
In that house in particular. But something to do with meth and cooking it, you got to tear a house down.
And also the people that were in it, they got busted because they were stealing. I always thought this was insane. They were stealing furniture. So they were stealing, like, they would break into people's houses and steal, like, armoires and stuff.
What?
Yeah, like, they would steal, like, mid-century modern furniture.
That seems very difficult to steal.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It's like 400, 500 pound, like, chest of drawers and stuff.
And then where do you sell that? Is there a black market for an armoire?
Well, I mean, if you're on meth, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know.
I'll trade you this chest of drawers for meth?
Yeah, I don't know. They were stealing furniture. Like, that's
bonkers.
Yeah, that's a weird thing to steal. They weren't stealing Apple devices. They were stealing like armoires.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds like a fascinating place to record an album and to just sort of hang out in for a while. Yeah. You said it was a couple months out there?
It was 2 months.
Two months.
Yeah. So what we did was we had it 2 months and we planned on rehearsing for like, we would just go out there like a job every day. Because at that time, like, nobody had heard the song. All the songs were completely new.
Mm-hmm.
So like we hadn't been playing them on the road or anything.
Right.
So we had to actually like figure out how to work them up. And we'd never spent more than like 10 days on a record.
Right.
And so we're like, hey, let's see what it's like if we like turn into Steely Dan and like spend 2 months. And we just rehearsed and kind of worked the songs up for like 3 weeks or so. And then we spent a month just tracking it and just trying out stuff.
Yeah. So Long Live All of Us, you spend 2 months practicing it, getting used to it, recording it, comes out. For me, the last song is like clearly, the last song of this record clearly seems to be saying like goodbye. Did you know that that this would be a break from 2011 to 2017? Like,
no, I mean, I thought when I was writing it, the whole idea behind that record was to write a pop, like, you know, I at the time, again, I was listening to like so much R&B and gospel music, and there was like, you know, something in that music that has also been stripped away, which is like there used to be a positive element in some certain genres. There's a positive element in a lot of old R&B and a lot of gospel music, obviously, is very uplifting and kind of positive. So I was like, I mean, that was the whole idea for that record, and the title and everything was like, let's make a record that like, and I wanted to make a record selfishly for myself that in the future that like would give me hope.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted, and I was just like, I know this is not the cool thing to do. This is not like a rock and roll thing to do, is write a positive record, but like, well, we're going to do it anyway.
No, I think it's great. Like, I've always thought it's like optimistically melancholy.
Yeah,
like
it's still melancholy, but it's trying to be melancholy in the worst circumstances, you know, like even though like shit's hitting the fan, like trying to see like some kind of light in it, you know?
Right.
And so, I mean, that's kind of that song, that the ghost in the vapor. I mean, it's a lot of biblical references like that. I mean,
sure.
That's just a line from the Bible where I was just trying to, a lot of those songs, like The Trouble Won't Last Always, and
we, oh, yeah.
You know, and like Everything Comes Back.
It is super optimistic.
Yeah, yeah.
It's great. I just wonder, like, hearing it now in 2017, you're celebrating your 20 year. It's been, we were talking outside earlier, you said it's been 4 years since you played your last show. I don't know how many years it was prior to that you played your last show. Looking at it in hindsight, through the lens of hindsight, this could definitely be a record that's saying, you know, take care of yourself
kind
of thing.
Yeah.
You know? So I guess that basically catches us up. Like, this record comes out in 2011. I assume you tour on it for a while.
We toured on it as much as we humanly possibly could. The most probably consistent touring that we've done in a long time, and that's kind of when Eric started having physical problems, and we had to, like, Eric, the drummer, he started having really bad issues with his arm. And
sure.
We went on, like, a six-week tour across the United States and then came back and then went to South by for 2 weeks and then went to, like, Europe for 6 weeks, like, all connected in a row.
Wow,
and
holy shit.
His arm was just
gone. Yeah, it's brutal.
Yeah. And so, and then that's when we had to cancel tours, and then we had to go on a break, and then he had to kind of figure out if he could get back to it. And then at the time, and you know, the thing about the band too is, like we were saying earlier, is we always had day jobs.
Right.
We never could rely on the band. I mean, Glossary tried to get a booking agent the entire history of this band.
Never
could get a booking agent.
No, not till like the end. And at that time, it was just like,
it was like one of a friend. Yeah, somebody not even the agents.
Yeah.
It's flabbergasting.
Yeah.
He did a great job with what he could, but it was just like, you know, you didn't have like the support of that big booking agency behind you. You couldn't get on.
Right.
Yeah. So he's just like working his ass off all the time to try to get whatever we could get.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
But yeah, we never.
It was terrible, but it was fun.
I mean, we realized, I think, a long time ago that we were like, we're a cult band. You know, we have a core group of people that, like, they got it. They
right.
saw, I mean, the whole, like I was saying, the thing about, like, when we kind of moved into the second era of the band, the whole thing I was saying about, like, that kind of grandpa knowledge is that I realized that, like, the things that I really like about art in general, or artists, or, like, art, the art tour, is that the work has an ideology and, like, belief system behind it. And so the idea was that the band would like have a belief system, like the songs would all have like a kind of a moral compass behind them. They would all be about like the great attributes of human beings, which are like forgiveness and second chances and redemption and things like that. And as long as we just stay with those type of things, like, and again, it's not a very rock and roll thing to like be singing about this stuff, but we're like Southern, so we're like completely wrapped in this stuff all the time. And it's, you know, everybody comes from very blue collar backgrounds with like broken homes,
or,
you know? And so like, the whole idea was like, if we could keep to those things, that eventually somebody would catch on to like the kind of the ideology of the band, that the band like stood for like these kind of, you know, these things. And, you know, that's kind of what happened on like a small scale, is that we got a very loyal following of people that were like super fans, you know, that connected with on that level.
That was a conscious thematic element on your part.
Oh yeah. I always tried to have it like that. I mean, if you look at like, even like the titles of the records, they're all very like almost biblical kind of like, they're all like very like uplift, like positive.
Sure.
Like, yeah. I mean, that all the songs would be about like, you know, I figure like if you write about like, there's only the world only has a few universal truths, and that is that we all know that you're born and you die. You are born of a man and of a woman. Like, you, everybody has a mom somewhere, everybody has a dad somewhere, although, I mean, some of that is obviously changing, depending on, but we all have these same thing, kind of truths. Like we know every day we're like the only animal on the planet that knows every day when they wake up how it ends.
Right.
Like you have to live with that every day, knowing that like your dog doesn't know that, your cat doesn't know that, but you do.
You're right.
You know that this has an end. And so that if we wrote songs, if the bands like worked in that realm, like that the songs dealt with like family and being like and mortality and like redemption, forgiveness, and like trying to reach to be the best that you can, like everybody could relate to that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know? No, totally. I coming in here tonight, I was re-listening to as much of the discography as I could, and that it really struck me that there are so many like pontifications about the brevity of life, like as a good thing, but there are a lot of references to just like kind of appreciating it while you're here, sort of thing. It does stand out a lot, so that effort was well done, because there it is. It's clear when you listen to the music that that's what's happening.
Well, I mean, I think the band too, it connected in a way, because at the time, like, a lot of that stuff stems from the fact that when I was 9 years old, we found my mom dead. Mm. And so I from that time on, I knew like, okay, this is temporary.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then like when we started the band, like Kelly's dad died.
Yeah.
And Todd's mom had just passed away before he entered the band.
Goodness.
And so, you know, I think Eric kind of had an estranged relationship with his father, his biological father. And, you know, I think at that time, too, BJ kind of had an estranged relationship with his dad when we first started going on. And then he rebuilt, or he got back closer to his dad.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, so I think we all came from, like, these kind of broken home, all, like, kind of poor kids. And, like, so...
Well, it's amazing that you still wrote songs that were all consciously optimistic.
Yeah.
Like, you're making an effort to say positive things about life. You're like, oh, this is so not cool for rock and roll to say this, but I'm going to make it uplifting.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that came from me, like, I was just listening to this, I always say that, like, records kind of, like, raised me. I didn't really have a huge, like, parental supervision when I was younger. And so, like, I kind of learned morality through records.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I kind of wanted to be that, to, like, the kind of broken kind of kid who didn't think that anybody was on their side, that, like, they could listen to something and, like, they could, like, maybe learn, like, something about being good, the rewards of being good, when nobody was there to give it to him, you know?
Yeah, like, that's a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I feel like we should just stop it right here. That's such a wonderful place to stop. I have lots more questions about, you know, recording and songwriting processes, but I mean, that is, that's just such a wonderful note to think about how music influences people. I mean, we can go for a lighter note. You can share your funniest story of the band, the most awkward. Turn it around, but
no, I mean, that's fine. We can leave it there.
I think it's good.
I think we're good there. Right. Yeah, because I don't want to get into the awkward stuff. I don't want to embarrass myself.
You don't want to get into the time where BJ drank a beer out of a fake leg.
No. I would love to get into where BJ drank a.
We just went there.
Yeah, I'm sure there's countless of those.
Oh, God.
I definitely. I mean, that's wonderful. That's absolutely. I mean, I thank you so much for your time and like. Sharing
it's
that
okay.
story.
You can end it on a fake leg.
I can end it on a fake leg.
Yeah.
In the story not even being told, just know that Bingham drank beer out of a fake leg.
It happened.